content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hi, this is Steve Lord from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to a half hour of captivating developments in science, medicine, technology, and the world around us, as reported in Discover, the magazine of science. Today's episode from the October, November, and December 2017 issues of Discover magazine features two short stories on smells and numbers, plus two longer stories on skepticism and stone tools. Who passes the smell test? An animal schnoz is obviously superior to our own mediocre noses, right? Not so fast. Matthias Laska, a biologist at Linköping University in Sweden, has been comparing senses of smell across species, including humans, for more than two decades. The more data I collect on different species over the years, the more interesting the picture became, Laska says. But sizing up how sensitive the snout of, say, a seal is compared with a bat or human isn't straightforward. People can tell you when a certain scent is no longer detectable, but each animal has to learn to associate a particular odor with a reward, and then do something, like press a button, to let researchers know when they smell it. The odors compared between species also have to be the same. That sounds obvious, but while humans have sniffed around 3,300 different scents for science, out of the trillions possible, the highest number for animals is 81, by spider monkeys. Laska only found solid enough data to compare humans with 17 species, all mammals. However, human noses held their own. Humans tested as generally more sensitive sniffers than monkeys and rats on a limited range of odors. In fact, humans detected certain scents at lower concentrations than the notoriously top-notch nostrils of mice and pigs. Humans even beat the indomitable dog for at least a handful of scents. These include aromas produced by plants, a logical evolutionary advantage for our ancestors seeking fruits. The majority of the odors in which dogs bested us were the fatty acids, compounds associated with their own meaty prey. Odors that are not relevant for you, you are usually not good at smelling, Laska says. Bottom line, humans, Laska says, are not as hopeless as the classical wisdom will tell us, and dogs are not the super nose of the universe for everything. Degrees of separation from gene variants to stamp-sized digital storage. 10 million. The number of new genetic variants researchers pinpointed across the Swedish population. They sequenced the complete genomes from 1,000 people, which will serve as a resource for other geneticists and could help diagnose diseases. 7. The number of genes scientists recently linked to insomnia risk. After combing through genetic data from over 100,000 individuals, researchers found the genes were more common in people who had trouble getting enough shut-eye. 1 minute. The amount of time, on average, per night, that a group of modern Tanzanian hunter-gatherers were all asleep at the same time. Experts say the minuscule overlap supports the notion that humans evolved different sleep patterns as a way to ensure someone was up to alert others of nighttime threats, such as predators. 1.5%. The average reduction in telomere length in children who sleep 1 hour less per night. The length of the telomere, a protective cap on the ends of each chromosome, limits the number of times a cell can divide over a person's lifetime. 16,200. The number of students researchers surveyed over the course of 10 years about their math skills. Compared with boys, girls were less likely to perceive themselves as being good at math, even when there was no significant difference in their mathematical abilities. This mindset could help explain the gender gap in physical sciences, engineering, math, and computer science fields. 5,300. the number of full-length movies scientists could one day cram onto a storage device the size of a postage stamp. The key is supercooling magnetized molecules to minus 351 degrees Fahrenheit. At that temperature, each molecule can maintain its polarization, which denotes whether the data is represented by a 0 or a 1, without needing a magnetic field. No denying it. What happens when the scientific data don't play along with the view we have of ourselves? How do they do it? How do science deniers manage to convince themselves that the evidence for global warming, evolution, and vaccine safety is so much fake news? For those of us who prefer to remain based in reality, the denialists represent a conundrum. Plenty of them are intelligent and educated, yet they just will not accept scientific findings as true. At least, not when it comes to inconvenient truths that mess with their self-interest or self-identity. Luckily, most science geeks would never deny the subtle science in a field where multiple peer-reviewed, placebo-controlled studies find the same thing over and over. They would never be lulled into believing that thousands of scientists have conspired to delude people into accepting a phony consensus. Or would they? Late in 2013, a week before Christmas, the Annals of Internal Medicine published three papers on the role of vitamin and mineral supplements in the prevention of disease or death. The first reviewed three large trials of multivitamins and 24 trials of single or combined vitamins involving over 400,000 people. The conclusion? No convincing evidence that the supplements prevent or delay cancer, heart disease, or death. The second study, a randomized trial following 5,947 men aged 65 or older for 12 years, found no difference in the mental functioning or verbal memory of those who took a multivitamin versus those who took a placebo. The third compared a high-dose 28-component multivitamin with placebo in 1,708 men and women who had survived a previous heart attack. After 4.6 years, no difference was seen between the two groups in their subsequent rate of heart attacks or strokes. An editorial accompanying the three studies noted, "Evidence involving tens of thousands of people randomly assigned in many clinical trials shows that beta-carotene, vitamin E, and possibly high doses of vitamin A supplements increase mortality, and that other antioxidants, folic acid, and B vitamins and multivitamin supplements have no clear benefit." Of course, all vitamins, by definition, are essential for health in small amounts. And while doctors do sometimes prescribe particular vitamins to treat specific medical conditions, most of us get all we need from food. It's the widespread belief in vitamin supplements to prevent or treat heart disease, cancer, Alzheimer's, or the common cold that simply does not stand up to scientific scrutiny. The same month that those papers were published, Gallup released a poll showing that 50% of Americans said they regularly take a multivitamin or any other type of vitamin or mineral supplement. Interestingly, the higher the education level of the person, the greater the chances that they took a vitamin. Just 43% of those with only a high school education said they took a vitamin, compared with 51% of those with some college, 55% of college graduates, and 65% of those with postgraduate degrees. No reliable national polls on the subject have come out since. But a May 2016 report by Nielsen examined sales data from 91,000 grocery, drug, convenience, and value stores, analyzing approximately 738,000 individual SKU product codes in 53 categories. In other words, pretty much everything sold in retail outlets. It found that vitamins and supplements had the largest increase in total store sales over the past 2 years, outpacing sales of food and, well, everything else. By comparison, the proportion of people who deny that global warming is caused by pollution from human activities, who insist it's simply a result of natural changes in the environment, dropped from 46% in 2010 to just 31% in 2016, according to Gallup polls. As for herbal remedies, in 2015, New York's Attorney General Eric Schneiderman released results of DNA testing of echinacea, ginseng, and St. John's wort from four national retailers: Target, Walmart, Walgreens, and GNC. Just 21% of the test results from store brand herbal supplements verified DNA from the plants listed on the product's labels, Schneiderman's office reported, with 79% coming up empty. He asked retailers to halt sales of the products. The next year, Nutrition Business Journal conceded that intuition would suggest that the New York Attorney General's actions in early 2015 would have hurt sales. But the herbs and botanicals category is one of the strongest categories NBJ tracks. Internet sales in the category grew at an astonishing 19.4%. It makes you wonder why people are doing this, says Elizio Golar, the epidemiologist at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, who wrote the 2013 editorial in the Annals of Internal Medicine. I wish we had better data about what the thought process is in people's heads. Perhaps, and this is just a wild guess, it's due in part to the relentless advertising and marketing of supplements. Because of the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act of 1994, manufacturers of vitamins, herbs, and other supplements are not required to prove to the FDA that a product is either safe or effective before selling it. Moreover, they can legally market any product with vague claims such as maintains immune function, so long as they don't specifically say that it actually treats or cures anything. But advertising isn't so all-powerful. If it were, those television commercials by the fossil fuel industry would have convinced everyone by now that coal can be clean. So why do products like Coldies and Airborne keep on selling, even after class action suits and Federal Trade Commission actions alleging that their claims of treating the common cold were unsubstantiated? One could point to the increasingly negative view that Americans hold about the mainstream healthcare system. Back in 1975, Gallup asked how highly people regarded various institutions in American society. When it came to the medical system, 44% of Americans said they had a great deal of confidence in it, while 36% said they had quite a bit. A mere 13% said they had only some confidence, and just 4% said they had very little. Jump ahead 4 decades to 2016, and the change is startling. Only 17% said they had a great deal of confidence in the medical system, and only 22% had quite a lot. The two combined dropped by more than half, from a total of 80% in 1975 to 39% in 2015. By contrast, the proportion who said they had some confidence more than doubled, from 13% to 36%, while the segment who had very little jumped nearly sixfold to 23%. It's nothing personal against traditional healthcare providers. Another Gallup poll from December 2016 found the highest-rated professions for honesty and ethical standards to be nurses, with 84% of people rating them very high or high, followed by pharmacists at 67% and medical doctors at 65%. Health insurers, on the other hand, may be drawing most of the incoming fire against the broader health system. Only 12% of respondents in the same poll ranked HMO managers as very high or high on ethical standards, compared with 31% who rated them low. Whatever the reason, the American public today is more inclined to listen to an industry selling natural supplements than to a medical establishment selling boring old science. Ultimately, beliefs stay in place when they fulfill a need and strengthen people's sense of identity, of who they are or what they aspire to be. Dan Cahan, professor of law and psychology at Yale Law School, sees public understanding of science through what he and other researchers call cultural cognition. He has investigated people's conflicting views on climate change, new technologies, and other areas where public perceptions trail scientific consensus. Cultural cognition can influence everything from what people believe they have seen with their own eyes to how they perform a mathematical calculation, he told me. With the goal of maintaining their status in some affinity group, people are very resourceful when it comes to making arguments. It's easy to go on the internet and to find support for just about anything. So liberals take vitamins and other supplements because they love all things natural and hate big pharmaceutical companies and private insurers, while corporation-worshipping conservatives take them because they love free markets and hate nanny state bureaucrats telling them what they can and can't take for their own health. And science nerds of all stripes who wonder how anyone can be so ignorant as to deny clear scientific results might try this experiment. Open a bottle of multivitamins, put one in your mouth, and swallow the bitter pill of self-recognition. Stone Cold Science. Researchers develop new ways to discover how our oldest tech and our brains evolved. In the Kent State University Laboratory for Experimental Archaeology, the Spot Hog Hooter Shooter, an automatic bow launcher, fires arrows filmed by high-speed cameras. The arrows are tipped with stone points, which are replicas of ancient artifacts. The replicas are worthless, so we can break them and use them in ways that we can't with the real artifacts that are priceless, explains archaeologist Metin I. Aaron, who leads the lab. To better understand ancient stone tools, his team creates facsimiles and tests their mechanical properties. It's just one of the cutting-edge ways archaeologists study humanity's oldest and arguably most pivotal technology. Without stone tools, says Aaron, we wouldn't be the species we are today. As early as 3.3 million years ago, human ancestors began bashing rocks into tools, a move that set our lineage on a distinct evolutionary path. For the next 99% of our time on this planet, our ancestors depended on stones to survive, for hunting, food preparation, constructing clothes and shelter. While artifacts made of wood and other perishable materials degraded, those made from rock endured. Thus, stone tools provide the richest record of human behavior across time and space. Archaeologists have dug up billions of them. Every one of those artifacts has a story. It has a history of the people that made it and used it, says Christian Tryon, an archaeologist at Harvard University. It's just a matter of learning to read the stones. Here's the problem. Stone tools are the least familiar things we excavate, says archaeologist John Shea of Stony Brook University. When you find a pot, you can say, it looks like a pot. Or you find a temple, it looks like a temple. Because stone tools are a forgotten technology, the purpose behind different styles is not self-evident. Scholars in the 19th century devised names like scraper, point and burin, based on shape and assumed function, but they had no evidence that scrapers scraped or points impaled. Unsure how stone tools were used, archaeologists fared better at determining how they were made. Typically, a rock, the hammer stone, was used to strike another rock, the core, to remove a slender piece, the flake, that was further sculpted into the desired form, such as an arrowhead or knife. To ensure the flake fractured with the right proportions, toolmakers often first shaped the core by knocking off scrap pieces in a systematic way. Researchers deduced these steps through feats of reverse engineering. In the 1894 book, Man the Primeval Savage, Worthington G. Smith reported his efforts to reassemble flakes and scraps into their original cores, like a 3D jigsaw puzzle. For 3 years, he studied 2,259 pieces recovered from a site in England, managing to rejoin more than 500 of them, and concluding that shellac dissolved in spirit was the best adhesive for the job. Though tedious, this methodology of refitting has proved essential for understanding stone tool production. Some reassembled cores have dozens of pieces, each a step in a complicated sequence of premeditated maneuvers. Making a stone tool is not a random procedure, says Tryon. It's not easy, either. Every year, Tryon teaches archaeology undergrads basic tool making. The students struggle to produce forms perfected long ago by human ancestors. Most people think you need to beat the hell out of these things, says Tryon, that it requires brute strength. It does not. It's more finesse. It's rhythm. It's gesture. Aaron started making stone tools in college classes, but to become an expert, he trained at the University of Exeter under Bruce Bradley, as well as with Jacques Peregrin and Robert J. Patton, all renowned for their tool-making skills. It was like a true apprenticeship, Aaron recalls. For 2 years, Aaron practiced the craft about 8 hours a day, save one day a week, when he restocked his rock supply by hiking the beaches of South England, loading a backpack with 150 pounds of flint. Now he can create any tool type by hand from the 6,000 pounds of rocks his lab houses, shipped from around the world. When identical copies of tools are required, his team uses lapidary equipment, or rock cutters, to mass-produce them. This unlimited supply of replicas, as many as we need for statistical validity, Aaron says, enables them to conduct destructive experiments, like firing from the Spot Hog Hooter Shooter. The goal is to test why tools had certain properties. Was a form preferred because it was aerodynamic, durable, or just in fashion? Aaron recently investigated tools made by early Americans some 13,000 years ago called Clovis points, which have distinctive channel-like divots known as flutes. Based on debris found at archaeological sites, Clovis people broke about 15% to 20% of their points while trying to flute them. The risky habit has perplexed scholars, with some speculating that it was an artistic flourish, a way for toolmakers to show off. But in a study this year in the Journal of Archaeological Science, Aaron and co-authors found that fluting was practical. Through computer simulations and experiments that included mechanically crushing replicas with controlled force, they showed that flutes provided shock absorption, preventing points from breaking upon impact. Replication experiments demonstrate what different types of stone tools could have done, but they do not reveal what any particular artifact did. About a decade ago, that question drove Gillian Monnier, an archaeologist at the University of Minnesota, to put an artifact under an electron beam. It was clear there was stuff on that tool. I didn't know what kind of stuff, but there was stuff, recalls Monnier. She became intrigued by the possibility that artifacts might preserve particles from softer materials they once contacted, such as animal hides and wood. Residue analysis got started in the 1970s, but materials were often identified by their visual appearance under a microscope, a highly subjective method. Other approaches, which measured elemental or molecular composition, were considered reliable, but destroyed the residue. Monnier wanted to find an accurate but non-destructive approach, so she began gunking up tools with known substances, the same way our ancestors might have done. Whittling wood, slicing roots and grasses, even processing animal parts. Getting blood wasn't too difficult in Minnesota, she adds. I was able to call my butcher, who knows me pretty well now. Monnier had colleagues perform traditional residue analysis on the objects and found that most residues cannot be visually distinguished with confidence under a normal microscope. In one study, trained researchers misidentified Monnier's modern specimens nearly 1 in 4 times. Since then, Monnier and colleagues have experimented using infrared and other forms of radiation to measure residue composition. results on modern materials as well as artifacts with known residues have been promising. In a 2013 study, for example, researchers removed bits of residue from stone points up to 130,000 years old and used a destructive technique to identify the substance as bitumen. This natural tar likely adhered the points to wooden spears that had long since decomposed. That same year, Monnier analyzed some remaining gunk on the same tools with X-ray and infrared beams, and also identified bitumen, proving it was possible to do it non-destructively. Having verified her methods, Monnier is eager to analyze unstudied artifacts and probably get some surprises. Some researchers think stone tools can answer the big questions in human evolution. How do we differ from other primates? And when did our unique human traits emerge? Chimpanzees and some monkeys use tools to a limited extent. They crack open hard-shelled foods with stones as natural hammers and anvils. Pre-human ancestors began breaking rocks to get sharp edges as early as 3.3 million years ago. By 2.6 million years ago, they did so in a standard way, producing what archaeologists call Oldowan tools. But a major innovation transpired around 1.8 million years ago. Homo erectus began sculpting rocks into intentional forms, making teardrop-shaped tools known as Acheulean hand axes. According to Shea, these hand axes were shaped to be carried efficiently. The average length and width are identical to a Samsung Galaxy 7. Researchers hypothesize that the technological leap was driven by a cognitive leap, an evolution in brain wiring. To test this, Shelby Putt, an anthropologist at the Stone Age Institute and Indiana University, compared the brains of modern people making Oldowan and Acheulean tools in a study published earlier this year in Nature Human Behavior. As trained volunteers worked stones, they wore caps sprouting wires connected to functional near-infrared spectroscopy, FNIRS. This neuroimaging technique is like MRI, but allows subjects to move freely. When participants made Oldowan tools, brain areas lit up related to vision and movement. Chimps smashing nuts probably engaged this level of cognition. Acheulean tool-making, however, required integration of higher-order regions that are responsible for sensory and motor control, memory, and planning. In fact, it was a brain network nearly identical to what's activated when people play the piano. "We don't see any chimps playing the piano," says Putt. She believes that Acheulean tools mark a turning point in our evolution from ape-like to human-like brains. The species that made that turn went extinct long ago, but the stone tools that bore witness to it survive, a common heritage of all humanity, says Shea. We've run out of time for today's episode of Discover, the Magazine of Science. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. Till then, expand your mind. I'm Steve Lord, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.